Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. In a previous episode, I said that I didn't think I was going to really be able to say much about the libraries included in Slackware. It's the L software series. And, I mean, they're libraries. They're software libraries. You use them when you're programming, and you usually use them for a relatively specific, not literally function, but a specific function. For instance, you need to parse raw photo data, photos taken in the raw format. You would use libraw, and there's not a whole lot to say about that unless I were to go through like the specific functions of the library, which doesn't sound all that interesting, at least not in context of what you're doing. I have been surprised so far, actually. The L section has been more interesting and more interactive, if you will, than I had anticipated. So I might have some things to say about some libraries, is the point. I mean, some of them actually even have, in the package shipped with Slackware, some of them even have things in the bin folder, user bin, like commands you can run. So some of them are... You know, they're more than just a library, I guess. I haven't gone through all of them, so the story could change as we get into sort of the depths of presumably, I don't know, 20, 30, 50 lib this, lib that. Like, that might be the breaking point. I might just have to announce, yes, there's a bunch of libraries. Moving on. Who knows? But for this episode, there's actually stuff to talk about. But before I do that, I'm going to just kind of reiterate. This is the way that I've been doing this is, you know, previously I was just going to the software list of Slackware 14.2. And now that we're on 15.0, I'm just going through I just went right into 15.0. So I've probably missed some things out of 14.2 or out of 15.0 that wasn't in 14.2. That's fine. We're getting close enough. If you want to like try to travel along, there are two ways to do that in Slackware. You can go to some site like FTP dot, and that's not like FTP colon slash slash. It's the name of the domain. ftp.osuosl.org/pub/slackware/slackware64-15.0/slackware64/l. So in other words, you go to a place where Slackware is distributed. So a Slackware mirror. And, you know, there are different servers around the country, around the world, what am I talking about, that have mirrors that host a lot of open source projects, and some of them also host Slackware. They just mirror exactly what's on Slackware's main server and copy it to their own server on a daily basis or whatever. And that way you can get the content from not just one server. This is an old way of doing what essentially, I guess, in a way we think of as a cloud capability today. Like, one of the big advantages of a cloud is that when one person wants a resource, there's one server out there and they can get that resource from that one server. And when 100 people want a resource, they can probably all live off of that one server as well. But you start getting 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 people who want something, and suddenly one server is just not going to be able to handle all the traffic. And so you divide the load, you balance that server load across, say, two servers. Suddenly you're good again. All the traffic can be handled more or less. You add more people to it, yeah, you make it maybe a third, a fourth, a fifth, a 20th server. That's what the mirroring system provides within open source. It's very, very similar now with the cloud, except instead of copying files from one server to another, you simply spin up a virtual server, a little pod, within a big network of lots of computers that are always on and have lots and lots of little pods running various services for them. People go to the array, the cloud, the big mesh, the big, you know, network of nodes. And when they want a service, then their traffic can be routed by this huge megalith into the pod that is appropriate for the service that they're looking for. If suddenly 100,000 people want that service, you can just spin up 10 pods or 20 pods or 100 pods and direct traffic accordingly with something to control that traffic, an ingest controller traffic. Something like that. So that is what this mirror network does. It just makes sure that a lot of people can get this resource no matter where they are physically on the globe, and no matter how many people want it at any given time. So go to your Slackware mirror. If you don't know where there are Slackware mirrors, you can do a /etc/slackpkg/mirrors. That shows you all of the mirrors all around the world. There's some in Australia. You just keep scrolling down and then you'll see that there are some in Austria and Belarus and Brazil and Bulgaria and Canada and so on. And so there's just a big old list of servers there. You copy and paste one into your browser, and then you navigate to Slackware 64-15.0, Slackware 64, and then you've got all the lists, or all the software series, as they called it. As I understand it, it was called the software series because it was literally a series of floppy disks a long time ago. Now they're just folders in a folder in a server. So I'm now, as of this episode, we're in the L directory, and the first one, because of capitalization and how things get sorted, is gconf-3.2.6. And looking at, I'm going to do it at /var/log/packages/gconf with a capital G and a capital C. That's important because gconf with a lowercase g and c is a different thing. So I'm on 3.2.6, yep, okay. And it says gconf is the GNOME configuration library. Gconf is a configuration database system designed for the GNOME project and applications based on GTK+. It is conceptually similar to the Windows registry. So you might wonder why we would need gconf on Slackware if we don't even ship gconf. GNOME. And that's because gconf isn't only used by literally like GNOME, the desktop. There are applications often written in GTK or GTK+, maybe, I don't know, that expect a database where they can save their settings, and that database is gconf. You might have reservations about gconf because you might think, well, why do we need a database, a registry, when we could just save the things that we want in plain text files on the system? And I mean, I can't argue with you. I feel the same way. And I know that kind of goes in conflict maybe of some other things that I've said about other databases or other binary stashes of data, which, I mean, that's a database, I guess. Although it doesn't have to be, right? So anyway, I've said before, like, well, you know, it just seems like the binary format is just better for searching. It's faster. It's, you know, you don't have to scrub through byte for byte looking for a specific string and then extracting the next string and so on. So I think there is an argument, a valid argument, for a binary store of data. I think if there wasn't that argument, I don't think we would see it. I really don't. We would see it. We would see it because a lot of people mistake making something difficult to access with keeping something safe / secret / proprietary, whatever. So people would use it because they would think, well, if we obfuscate the data, then no one will know what's going on. Forgetting, of course, that you're putting something on people's computers and giving them all the time in the world to sit there and reverse engineer it. So you are putting that arbitrary sort of annoying blockade between the thing that you are distributing and the ability for people to understand it, which is annoying. The other side of that, though, is that you're providing, it's certainly in gconf's case, they're providing this data store on your computer, and they've documented it, and they've given you the tools to analyze it and look at it from lots of different angles and so on. So I think that there's probably a very good argument for gconf. I imagine that probably a lot of people are very appreciative that gconf exists. I'm not one of those people. I'm not a fan of gconf. I've used binary configuration options before and have not enjoyed using them at all. That doesn't mean they're not any good. I'm just saying that's not what I prefer. A lot of the, well, as far as I can think of, like, all of the configuration for KDE, I'm sure there's something that I'm forgetting, but all the configuration for KDE is pretty much in plain text files in your home directory. So I don't know. I'm just not that much of a fan. So I don't, and I even wonder whether it's really that necessary. It might be, you know, who knows? Like, I don't know. But I don't know. I don't love it, but it exists, and there are tools to manipulate it, which I think is quite important. So in this package, there are some documentation files, there are some include files, and then there are some user bin commands in user bin. Gconf merge tree, gconf tool-2, gsettings data convert, and gsettings schema convert. So I think instead of starting at the top, I'm going to start with gconf tool-2, which is a tool to manipulate a gconf configuration. And this is where it comes into play, where you have to learn the tool in order to sort of interact with the data. That's the barrier. That's the almost necessary barrier when something is stored in a binary format. Now you have to essentially decode it. And for you, that doesn't literally mean, oh, you have to figure out the cipher, but you do have to figure out the tool that knows the cipher. And the tool in this case is gconf tool-2. So if you want to see the settings of your gconf registry, or whatever they call it, you can use gconf tool-2, and with this tool, you can set the values of keys, you can display the values of keys, you can install schemas from schema definition files while installing an application. The weird thing about this tool, gconf tool-2, is that you're essentially exploring a file system, and it's not your file system, it's the database, it's the gconf database. And so when you want to explore that, you have to learn the language. So it's just as if, though, someone had sat you down in front of a raw data dump of a WordPress site and said, hey, could you find the blog post I did yesterday? If you were sitting in front of WordPress, you could probably do that. I mean, if you've ever used WordPress or you had the time to click around. But just the raw database, that's probably a different question. So how do you navigate the database? Well, you do, it's structured as if though it was a file system, just a lot, I guess, I want to say more minimal, but maybe that's not fair. It's got fewer top-level directories, let's put it that way, at least by default. I mean, on Slackware, it might be a lot more complex elsewhere, I don't know. Gconf tool-2 space --- all dash dirs, as in directories, so --- all dirs space --, just like a file system. You want to look at the root level, the root or the top of the directory tree. So say that, and it shows you, it returns /system and /desktop. So I'm going to favor desktop because I happen to know I have some entries there. So gconf tool-2 space --- all dirs space /desktop. So we're looking in the quote unquote desktop folder. Okay, well, in this desktop folder, there's a GNOME subfolder. All right, so once again, gconf tool-2 space --- all dirs space /desktop /GNOME. And it looks like there are some URL handlers in here. Okay, URL handlers. I'm adding that to the end of the thing. And then there's a bunch of, so /desktop /GNOME /URL handlers /HTTPS or Chrome or TG or FTP or HTTP. So you kind of get the idea that you're looking around through this structure of data which is structured as if though there were file paths. Now in these quote unquote directories, there may be, let's again just using an analogy here, there may be some files. Now these aren't really files, they're actually keys, and the keys have values, but I mean, isn't that kind of what a file is? It's kind of an inode key with a bunch of data inside of it. So, I mean, arguably. So, gconf tool -2--notAlders, we're going to do something different. We're going to do recursive -list, I think is what it is. Recursive -list, yeah. /desktop/gnome. Let's just keep it really kind of simple. I guess we could even do desktop, maybe. Is that a thing? Oh, that is. Okay, so gconf tool -2--recursive -list /desktop. This shows you that, hey, there's this subdirectory called gnome, and within that directory, there are other directories, which we've already seen, but we're going to see the sort of the contents of this stuff now. So /desktop/gnome/url -handlers. Yeah, I remember seeing that. In that is a further subdirectory, let's call it. I guess at this point we might call it, no, let's call it that. /desktop/gnome/url-handlers/https. Command equals, that sounds like a key equals a value. So the command equals /opt/firefox/firefox/bin%s. Enabled equals true. So that's yet another key value pair. Needs_terminal=false. Key value pair. And then under that, there's the desktop gnome URL handlers, the HTTP. Well, they're all the same, actually. Yeah, they're pretty much basically all the same. But anyway, well, here's actually an interesting one. Gnome handler URL handler Chrome. Command equals opt Firefox Firefox bin percent s. I don't know where these come from, but there you go. These are the URL handlers that apparently gconf has assigned to a bunch of Firefox commands that I created because I install Firefox myself into opt, and I run it with a custom-made little desktop file. And I do that because Firefox is forever alerting me that I need to update it. And to try to update it manually, well, I do. I just mean, I have a script that just gets rid of the opt directory and downloads the latest build from Firefox, puts it into opt, and then I continue on my way. And probably the first time that I, placed the application.desktop file in my .local share applications directory, gconf probably integrated it into its little system. There you go. So, and you can continue, I mean, you get the idea. Now, there are lots of different commands, or rather options. There's --all -entries, for instance, to see all the keys in a specific directory. There's --dump. That'll give you a sort of a data dump. --get. Like I said, you can get the values, or, you can also --set. To set a value. So if you know that, for instance, that a gconf tool -2--set quote /desktop/gnome/foo should have a value of something, then you can do --type, and let's say it's a string, so you would type in string and then the string that you want to set it to. So quote bar. Close quote. And now you would have in your desktop gnome sort of folder, as it were. Again, this is all stuff in a database, so it's not really a file and file path. You would have an entry called foo, and the value for foo would be a string of letters, which is called bar, B-A-R. And there's a bunch of stuff that you can do like that. I found some really useful documentation on the different options that you could use just within the package itself. There, that's in the documentation for this package. I don't know that it's everything, but it's a bunch of stuff. All right, so that was gconf tool -2. Let's see what else we've got here in the package listing. Trying to get back to, there it is. Okay, here we go. Nope, that's the Slack build that I was looking at earlier. All right, I'll just most var log packages /gconf with a capital G and a capital C. Oh yeah, It was gconf merge tree. Merge tree, of course, it helps you merge different configuration files together. gsettings-data-convert helps you convert data from one gconf configuration to another. You know, it's used for migration, like if you've written an application for GNOME 3.9 and then GNOME 40 comes out. Yeah, they did a weird thing with their numbering. Then you can use this tool to convert the data. And then there's gsettings data convert and gsettings schema convert. There's a difference between gconf and gsettings. Gsettings are plain text files. Gconf, as I've said, is a database. So sometimes you need to convert from one to the other. Maybe someone wrote a simple application that they thought, oh, this is fine. I can just do this as a settings file. Or maybe that's just a legacy thing. I don't know. I couldn't find exactly what the intended use case for this was or the reason for its existence. But you can you can convert, you know, you can take your data from a gsettings, or rather gconf, and dump it out to a gsettings, or a schema for gsettings, you can convert to gconf, and so on. So there's a bunch of conversion things. They exist. I didn't try them, frankly. I kind of got bored of the whole concept. But that's gconf. That's everything. Next up is libraw. Libraw is a library for reading raw files from digital photo cameras. These are formats like CR2, NEF, DNG, DCR, and so on. Virtually all raw formats are supported by libraw. It's just something that it does. It pays special attention to correct retrieval of data required for subsequent raw conversion. The library is intended for embedding in raw converters, data analyzers, and other programs using raw files as the initial data. So here's the thing about raw. Raw just, it means that some device has recorded a lot of information about, well, let's just talk in visuals. So it has recorded a lot of information from its little light sensors, and it has written that information to some media. That's a raw format. Now, what that raw format looks like once you sort of look at the actual data can change, which is why you have a raw format labeled CR2 or CRW or NEF or DNG or whatever else there is out there. And there are a lot of them out there. And that's just, you know, someone might put the size of the sensor in one place while someone else puts the value of the luma levels of a specific region of the thing that was being photographed instead. So you have a lot of potential data within a raw file, and a raw file really isn't targeting one thing. That's sort of like the quote-unquote problem with raw. And when I say quote-unquote problem, I'm saying that because it is also the feature of raw. It is not assuming anything about the way that you are going to look at that data, which is a powerful thing, because that way it can give you all the data that it has available to it. The sensor width, the sensor height, the left border, the top border, bottom border, the different levels of luma for different pixels and so on. You got all of that information. Now, if the application that you look at that data in doesn't, I don't know, process, maybe it ignores the bounds. I don't know that it could do that actually, but maybe it ignores the value of foo. It doesn't know what to do with that. It's not that fancy of an application. It doesn't know what foo is in photographs. I mean, neither do I, because I'm making it up, but it doesn't need that information. Well, that's fine. When you import it, it will drop, you know, or it will do whatever it needs to do with foo, probably, assuming your application was written, you know, to support that format of raw. It'll get the values that it can work with. It will convert them to whatever color space and viewport that makes sense for you, and cache the rest of the data so that you can manipulate it, probably. And eventually, once you're happy with what you're seeing on your screen, you'll export it as something that is targeted to a specific, I say device, but really I mean a specific library. So for instance, you might get a good picture that you're happy with and you might think to yourself, okay, I'm done. I'm going to now export it as a TIFF image. No compression. I'm keeping as much of the data as I possibly can. It's going to be a huge file, but I really like this photograph and I'm going to blow it up to be really big. So that's what I want TIFF. Or you may think, well, I also want a little smaller copy that I'll just post online for people to download. And I'll do that as a WebP image. Well, now you've got a TIFF and a WebP image, and those are specifically targeted towards a library. If you send that WebP image to someone running some arcane operating system that's lagging behind in support for modern graphic formats, like, I don't know, Mac OS or something, then, or I think Safari specifically, for a very long time, it might have finally caught up. Couldn't look at WebP. And so they, you know, you send that picture, that WebP, to someone who doesn't have libWebP installed or whatever it is, then they won't be able to open that image file. That's just, that won't work. If you send someone a TIFF file and they don't have libTIFF installed, then that won't open. If you send someone a RAW file, but they have libRAW installed, then they'll be able to see the RAW photo. Now, in reality, of course, we're all kind of expected to have libRAW, libTIFF, libWebP or whatever it is, libJPEG, you know, all the standard ones. You kind of have the expectation, well, I'll have that installed. The advantage of libRAW is that you can send all kinds of RAW files to your computer from your phone or from your camera, your fancy camera or your less fancy camera, whatever. You got RAW files, you can send it to your computer. It will know how to decode all of that information into something that you can see, manipulate, and export into common things, into common formats that are useful, that are generally useful, which is good. So that's what libRAW does. Go to libraw.org for more information. Obviously, it doesn't do any of us any good for me to, like, I don't know, talk about, like, the functions that are available to that library or something like that. All right, let's talk about M2Crypto. That's a cryptography toolkit for Python. M2Crypto is a crypto and SSL library for Python. It includes RSA, DSA, DH, Diffie-Hellman, I guess, HMax, Message Digest, Symmetric Ciphers like AES, SSL, HTTPS, and so on. Lots of encryption algorithms, I guess. So this is important because if you want a Python application to talk to a server, for instance, that is communicating over SSL, then probably you want Python to just kind of magically know how to interpret that the signals that it's receiving back. And I think in a way that really succinctly kind of explains the use of a library. I used to kind of get confused sometimes when I was programming, especially with Python. You sometimes get confused about, well, I know how to do such and such with a command on the Linux terminal, and now I'm trying to write this Python application, and one of the things it needs to do is the same. It needs to do such and such. It needs to do whatever. I know how to do it with a command manually. I want to be able to write a script in Python to do the thing. And then you have to stop and you think, well, wait a minute, why am I using Python? Why don't I, if I know how to do it in a terminal, why don't I just, I'll just script it in Bash? Well, okay, that works for a while. You can just divorce yourself of anything but Bash, which, I mean, I try to do anyway, because I do feel that Bash is one of the more sort of accessible in terms of, like, broad reach languages. I mean, like, people who learn Linux in the first place are kind of naturally learning bits and pieces of Bash. And so Bash scripting is just kind of like that, but more. Whereas Python is just a complete change, right? It's just complete, total overhaul, completely different skill. So, I mean, any programming language is, you know, completely different than Bash. I'm just in this context, I'm talking about Python. So you have, you know, eventually you might think, well, okay, I've been able to do, you know, to progress this far with Bash, but now I really need to use Python or whatever, because of some reason. Maybe I'm interfacing with some other application. Maybe I want a GUI on my application. I don't feel good about any of, like, little, you know, little Bash options, like incurses and stuff. So, or you know, Zenity or whatever. So you think, okay, I really have to switch over to Python now. But how do you do the thing that you knew how to do in a terminal? And I think, I mean, Python, Java, C++, like, it doesn't matter what it is. It just, at some point, you're going to need to know how to do stuff that you used to know how to do somewhere else. And there's equivalence there for GUI processes too. You know, you knew how to rotate an image in GIMP. How do you do it in Python or Java or whatever? So let's go back to the Python example. Python. There's a thing in Python where you can essentially drop out of Python. You launch a shell and you can run commands in Python. And it's kind of a dangerous thing. It's one of those sort of cop-out things where if you learn about it, you're tempted very frequently to use it a lot more than probably you should. So there's that too. And that gets confusing because now you do know how to do a thing in Python by not doing it in Python. Eventually you get to the level though, where you realize, okay, I have to use this programming language. The application has to be written in that language because I can't count on the system that it's running on to have anything specific, any of the tools that I want to have. I can't count on those being there on the system. But if I'm writing everything natively in the language, then as long as the system it's running on has the language installed, it'll be good to go. And so you start writing stuff just in the programming language of your choice. In this example, Python. Suddenly, for this application, you need to get some information from a server. There are some easy ways to do that, but what if at some point you realize that the server you're talking to is using some kind of encryption scheme so that you can't just grab information from the server? You have to grab it in a specific format. Well, the M2 crypto library allows you to tell Python, you'll import that library into Python, and now Python inherits a bunch of new capabilities, and it can do all kinds of things. It can now talk in all these different kinds of protocols or languages or ciphers, really. And so when it gets what looks like garbage to you, when you got it with just a normal URL lib or HTTP lib or whatever, what is it, URL git, something like that, whatever Python uses these days, you grab it with that thing, and it looks like garbage. Put that output through your M2 crypto library, like some function in that, all of a sudden, it actually makes sense. Now, you could write that yourself, right? If you go look up the, for instance, SSL specifications, then you could figure out what the cipher is and how to decode it and what kind of keys you need and all these other things. But with M2 crypto, you import it, you use it, and you're done. And that's the strength of a library. You don't have to invent something because someone has already invented it. They've published it. They've released it as a library, or Python often calls it a module. Either way, it exists. That code is there. In this case, it's on gitlab.com/m2crypto. In other library cases, it's somewhere else. And it makes it really easy. You get to do all kinds of programming tricks without ever having to know how the trick was done. I've benefited from that sort of thing, well, too many times to count. I mean, some of us programmers pretty much just ride on libraries. I mean, it's really, you just learn how to string a bunch of libraries together and you've got workable programs sometimes. So it's pretty powerful stuff. I highly suggest that you get familiar with a good library or two if you're going to start programming, because that'll just change your abilities instantly. You suddenly become like a competent something, like whatever you're working on. You can all of a sudden you can talk to servers or manipulate images and lots of other things. So yeah, take a look at the libraries provided for your programming language of choice, and you'll be surprised. Okay, next note, we need to go have coffee. That's what we need to do. Let's go get coffee. And I am back with coffee. Hopefully you've gotten yourself a cup of coffee as well. I am trying a different coffee today. It is a local roast of some coffee beans. I got it because I was in Dunedin, a city called Dunedin, and where I go kind of just to, for fun, you know. So it's a cool city, not too far away from me. I go there because there's a good gaming store there. So I was there for a while, a couple of days. And I thought, well, I'm going to need coffee while I'm here. And so I bought this bag of coffee for the Airbnb where I was staying. And wouldn't you know, I was never at the hotel or the Airbnb long enough, really, to take advantage of any of the coffee that I'd purchased. Because there was so much to do in Dunedin. I had such a schedule that I ended up not using any of the coffee that I'd gotten. So brought it back and I am enjoying it now. It's quite good. It's a really fine grind. So I'm using it on my desktop and on my desktop coffee maker. No, on my stovetop coffee. Well, all of my coffee makers are, well, most of my coffee makers are stovetop. The little espresso one. Okay, so let's see. This is from Jim, and he says, this is the title is The Good and Bad of MDNS. So this is about the ZeroConf stuff that I was talking about, what, 2 episodes ago? Hi, Klaatu. I find MDNS on our home network very useful. It makes setting up a small single board computers much easier. There you go. I also can usually connect to our wireless printer more quickly using its .local address than waiting for our network's DHCP server to assign it an IP address. That said, MDNS can greatly reduce performance on large wireless networks. On a episode of the Heavy Networking podcast earlier this month, episode number 673, available at packetpushers.net, and I'll put the link in the show notes, they discuss a test performed by the guest, a network engineer at Dartmouth College. Normally, Dartmouth's network doesn't allow MDNS traffic, but for 1 hour, he removed the restriction on just the College of Engineering's network, then took packet captures and measured the effect on the network. Because the network has so many access points, over 400, all of which were broadcasting the MDNS frames of their wireless clients, the college's network traffic slowed to a crawl. Some 75% of the packets were MDNS traffic. It was effectively an internal DNS attack. I found the episode fascinating. I encourage you to listen to it if you have the time. So this is Klaatu again. Amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing. First of all, it's to back up, it is cool that it's useful on a home network. That does seem like it could be useful. And I guess the idea of having this thing active by default on a bunch of personal computers and then just turning it off at the access points kind of makes some sense. I think this kind of confirms exactly what I thought about MDNS. It's a noisy protocol. We all know this. If you know anything about ZeroConf or Avahi or Bonjour or MDNS or whatever we're calling it, you know anything about it, you know that it's a noisy protocol. It has to be, right? It's constantly announcing its presence on your network all the time to everything that will listen. It's telling it where, you know, it's announcing its presence. It's giving its identity. It's a noisy protocol. On a small network, that probably doesn't matter. You can do that. You can afford to do that. And I think in modern computing, sometimes that's what we do. We do stuff because we can afford it, because it is relatively cheap based on the resources available to us. It's weird how that happens, but I can think of a couple of examples where that has happened, you know, where hardware has started out as pretty cutting edge, and then I guess the software surpasses it, and then the hardware is just kind of, it's still there and it's still useful, but it's easier to use, it's cheaper to use now, because it's not like the software, it's not bearing the brunt, I guess, of everything, of all these processes. So the software can just kind of offload stuff to the hardware, or the software has cut out a bunch of excess things, and so it can do different calculations instead of the other ones, or whatever. I just feel like that happens sometimes, that we realize, okay, well, now it's really easy to do this thing, whereas before it used to not be easy. I mean, a RAM disk is a really quick and simple example. I use RAM disk all the time on my computer. I have it auto-mounting at the at boot. I use it as my temporary directory for my Audacity sessions when I'm recording this podcast, for instance. I use it for temporary storage for files that I'm downloading and working on at work and things like that. So I would have never been able to do that before, but now that I have, I don't know, what do I have, 24, 32 gigs of RAM in my computer or something? I can't even get all of my RAM being used. So I'm just literally using some of it as temporary instant storage, and it's quite nice. It's quote unquote cheap to do that now. And I think it's sometimes cheap on a network, on a small manageable network, to just broadcast your MDNS all the time. And if it saves you 5 minutes and keeps you from having to fiddle around with setting up your IP address preferences, or maybe you're not in an environment where that would make sense for you to set up, because really all the devices are frequently changing, then MDNS, maybe that does just make a lot of sense. But it is absolutely fascinating to me the effect that it has on a larger network. I'm really, really surprised by that. That is fascinating to me, that it was that drastic. I'm not surprised. It's just really cool that someone thought, let's just prove this thing that we all kind of know, but maybe we don't think about all that time. I mean, that's an important thing to be aware of, though, too. MDNS. I mean, if you ever inherit a sizable network, keep that in mind, that maybe that MDNS traffic, or ZeroConf or Bonjour or whatever you're calling it, maybe that's a thing that you should just drop. That shouldn't be something that gets propagated. Because it not only does it make for a heavy traffic network, it really does get cluttered on users' computers. I mean, we've all been to places where you open up your networking, you know, location type of, you know, your file manager or whatever to a network location, and you see all of these devices listed in your sidebar or in a folder, you know, virtual folders or whatever, where it's like, you know, Bob's HP and Andrew's MacBook and Sophie's Lenovo, you know, and you've got all these different people, or all these different devices sort of lingering, you know, in your file manager, and you don't want them there. You don't need to know about them. You don't need to know what brand computer Bob has or anybody else. And yet there they are. So blocking that is sometimes just a convenience all around, I think. But you do have to think as the admin, if you're the admin, you have to think to block it, because otherwise it'll just be there. Good or bad, it'll just do it. All right, let's talk about Mako templates for Python. Mako, M-A-K-O. It's a template library written in Python. And if you've ever used like Jinja 2 or what's the other one? I don't think it is for Python though. It's for like, is it for Ruby or something? There's another one. There are lots of template libraries out there. What they are is they're sort of hybrid markup languages that also know about a programming language. I kind of use this in my own bash script that I use to post this podcast. Not Mako, sorry. Just this concept. I have a bunch of HTML stuff, or XML rather, sorry, and then a line in there that's clearly delimited that is to be replaced. And then when I run my bash script, it downloads the thing, it finds that line, deletes the line, and puts where it was, it places the text for this episode, the description, the episode number, and so on. All the XML data, all the RSS and Atom feed data. And that's the same idea, sort of. So, for instance, maybe you're, auto-generating an HTML table. You can write that out yourself in Python. Like, you could do a bunch of print statements that are then generating the HTML, and then you could take that HTML and put it somewhere and show it to the user or whatever. But what you really want is for there to be a template library, a template file, and then a library that knows to look at that template file and swap out really quick all the computations that you wanted it to do, and retain all the markup. So for instance, you might have like, let's say a table that you're designing. So you could do an HTML table, not a desk. So, you know, you could do table tag and then percent sign to sort of break out of the template. And you could just write your Python for row in rows. No, that's not Python. What is that? That must be Mako, actually. Dollar sign, curly brace, make row, parentheses row, close parentheses, close bracket, end for. And what that would do, and then end table. So what you would be doing there in theory is that you're telling Mako to, okay, well, stop, you know, make a table, and now to populate it, stop and take each row in this variable called rows. And for each time you do this, call it a row, and then run this this function called make row, and then you end the for, so it does that like 10 times or however many rows there are, and then it closes the table tag. And you could do that for whatever. It doesn't have to be tables, obviously. It can be a bunch of different things. And it's a library that understands a syntax designed to create documents. You import it into Python with just the usual sort of from mako.template, for instance, import template. That's the usual Python sort of incantation, import something. Or if you don't want to import the whole thing, then you say from something, import this part of it. And there's lots of different things that you can, that it's, I mean, it's designed, again, for documents. It's creating, like, HTML pages. That's what the template is for. Not that you can't have templates for other things, but that's what this is primarily aimed at, I think. And in fact, it Mako itself compares itself and says that it is pretty similar to Jinja 2. I'm not sure what its selling point is. Like, is it just yet another Jinja 2, or is there something unique about it? I'm not really sure. I've never used it. I've used Jinja 2 relatively heavily in previous jobs. Okay, finally for this episode, certainly not for the L directory in Slackware, Qcentilla. I'm assuming that's how you say it. It is a port of the Centilla C++ library, which is, if you'll recall, there was a library within the KDE frameworks called KDE Syntax Highlighting or something like that, or maybe it was Kate Syntax Highlighting. I think, yeah, it must have been Kate Syntax Highlighting or something like that. And it provided all these options for editors, for text editors, where it would pick up what language you're using, and it would highlight certain words based on whether they were a keyword or just a variable name. They would, I don't know, close quotes for you and stuff like that. That's basically what Qcentilla does. Although it's kind of geared towards like error finding, like, you know, for debuggers, essentially, like highlighting errors and putting a little marker in the margin so you can see it quickly, kind of scanning through just one vertical axis of your editor and so on. So this is something that exists, as I say, for C++ as Centilla. This is the Qcentilla library because it's specific to Qt, or rather it's written for Qt. That means that if you're doing an IDE or an IDE-like thing with the Qt framework, then you could use Qcentilla to get those features sort of automatically within your text editor. I have never used it. I've written a text editor for fun with the Qt framework. It's shockingly easy, or surprisingly? I think it's surprisingly easy, because it's still work, but it's pretty easy because there's so many things already there. This is one of those things. Like, you could just drop this in, and suddenly if people start writing code in your text editor, they'll get all kinds of cool features because you used this library. The cool thing about this package, too, is that it includes the C++ libraries, or rather, header files, the library itself, and the Python, like the Qt Python components required. So if you're writing a text editor with Qt Python, which is even easier, I still won't say shockingly, but very, very easy, then you could use this, Qcentilla, and just get all kinds of syntax highlighting and indicators and little warning symbols and all kinds of things in the text editor. And people would think that you'd worked really, really hard to get all that stuff in your IDE or your text editor, and really you haven't. You have simply imported Qcentilla or something like that. Now, I have skipped over PyQt 5 because I think that probably deserves an episode all its own, and I don't want to just leave it tagged on here at the end. So I'm going to do PyQt 5 next time, and as for this time, the time is up. Thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you next week.